Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello. This is a public service announcement for Sister Sound Community Chorus. Sister Sound, an all-women's chorus, will be presenting our first post-pandemic choral concert. Sister Sound will be singing at 7 p.m. on Saturday, January 21st, at Crestwood Christian Church. That is at 1882 Belafonte Road in Lexington. Tickets are available at the door. They are $10 for adults, which are children ages 12 and up. Children who are ages 4 to 11 are $5, and children under 4 are free. The theme for the concert is light. We will be singing about the light in our lives. Please come and join us for an uplifting evening of song.
Welcome to the reading of the Lexington Herald Leader. Today is Tuesday, January 17th, 2023, and your reader is Heidi Newman. As a reminder, Radio Eye is a reading service intended for people who are blind or have other disabilities that make it difficult to read printed material. Now, from our studios located in the Northside branch of the Lexington Public Library, please join me for this reading of the Lexington Herald Leader, donated to Radio Eye by the publishers. The headline story on page one is Thousands March to Celebrate 50 Years of Honoring MLK and Unity. This is an article by Beth Musgrave, and you can reach Beth Musgrave at bmusgrave@herald-leader.com. Thousands lined up in Lexington Monday to march through downtown to commemorate, honor, and celebrate the life of Martin Luther King, Jr. The 50th Annual Freedom March is one of the longest-running celebrations of the celebrated civil rights leader's legacy in Kentucky. Tim Mitchell and Gary Blair have been coming to the MLK March and celebration for decades. They aren't sure how many they have attended. It's been that long. Mitchell said he likes to come to see who is marching, particularly when it's cold, dreary, or rainy. They didn't wait until it was 85 to march in Selma, Blair said as the two waited in front of Central Bank Center prior to the march's start. King's life and accomplishments are worth honoring, Mitchell said. I applaud his work, Mitchell said. He went to Morehouse at 15. He has a Nobel Peace Prize. Lee Ridgway attended with members of his fraternity. Ridgway has come for several years. We must continue to strive to do better, Ridgway said. We want to continue to keep Dr. King's message alive. We still have a ways to go. The Sun also got an invite to Monday's 50th anniversary march. It was more than 40 degrees, balmy compared to recent years where temperatures dipped below freezing. In recent years, celebrations were also curtailed due to the coronavirus pandemic. Monday's Freedom March also saw the usual dignitaries and a who's who of Lexington and Kentucky. Governor Andy Beshear, Mayor Linda Gorton, and other current and former elected officials attended. The first march was in 1973 on the University of Kentucky's campus and was a much smaller and muted affair. Jerry Stevens, then the first head of minority affairs for UK, and Chester Grundy, who has been involved in the celebration for 49 of the 50 years, helped organize a small candlelight march in a program at UK's Memorial Hall. It attracted between 75 to 100 people, Grundy has said. In the 1980s, during the push to make MLK Day a national holiday, the march was expanded and included the Lexington-Fayette-Urban County government. The first joint march and celebration was held in 1986. After Monday's march, David Hall, president of the University of the Virgin Islands, gave the keynote address. Hall is known for his work on legal aspects of social justice and race. United Voices Chicago, formerly the Chicago Children's Choir, was also scheduled to perform. Monday's events were sponsored by UK, the Lexington Government, Spectrum, Bluegrass Community Foundation, Cornet, Bluegrass Community and Technical College, and Smiley P Publishing. King came to Kentucky multiple times. In 1964, King and Jackie Robinson attended a march in downtown Frankfort, where 10,000 people demanded legislation calling for the end of segregation and discrimination in Kentucky. That wasn't King's first step in Kentucky. His brother was a pastor of a church in Louisville, and King visited Kentucky's largest city often. In 1957, at just 28, King delivered the commencement speech at Kentucky State University. And that concludes Beth Musgrave's article entitled, Thousands March to Celebrate 50 Years of Honoring MLK and Unity. The second article from page 1 of the January 17th edition is Behind the Push to Get Muhammad Ali on a U.S. Postage Stamp. This is also an article by Beth Musgrave. When Lonnie Alley came to California to visit one of Muhammad Ali Center's newest board members in 2022, she noticed two framed photos in Peter Vilgress's home office. One was a postage stamp of Roberto Clemente, the famed Puerto Rican baseball player tragically killed at 38 in an airplane crash. The second was a stamp of Cesar Chavez, who formed the American Farm Workers of America, AFL, CIO. Vilgrass, who is also chairman of the California State Athletic Commission, which regulates boxing, told Lonnie Ali, "I should have Muhammad Ali's stamp up there." Muhammad Ali's widow told Vilgrass that would be impossible. "Muhammad Ali has never been featured on a U.S. stamp," she said. Vilgrass was stunned. "I, like most people, would automatically assume he was already on a stamp," Vilgrass said. "We got to get the champ a stamp," Vilgrass said. Lonnie Ali gave her stamp of approval. "He would have loved that," Ali said of Vilgrass's off-the-cuff "get the champ a stamp." Vilgrass, who idolized Ali, Vilgrass's daughter is named after him, is now behind the push to get Ali on a stamp. "It's only fitting. One of the Louisville natives' most colorful and famous quotes, 'I should be a postage stamp because that's the only way I'll ever get licked,'" he once said. Tuesday is Ali's birthday. He would have been 81 years old. Ali died in 2016 at 74 after a long battle with Parkinson's disease. Lonnie Ali said her late husband would be thrilled to be on a stamp. The two talked about it when Muhammad Ali was alive. He was excited and elated that there would be a stamp with a picture of him on it, Lonnie Ali said. He knew how many people would go out and buy it. More than 6 years after his death, a stamp would help continue Ali's legacy, she said. Ali's message is simple, she said, to be more compassionate, to be more giving to their neighbors, their fellow man, toward people they haven't met. A long process. Anyone can nominate someone to be featured on a U.S. postage stamp, according to the U.S. Post Office website. In 2018, the U.S. Postal Service changed the rules so only people who have been dead 3 years or longer will be considered for a stamp. The Citizen Stamp Advisory Committee, which chooses who will be featured on a U.S. stamp, also favors American or American-related subjects that honor extraordinary and enduring contributions to American society, history, culture, or environment. The nominees must be sent by mail, of course. Jean Conkey, Senior Director of Public Relations and External Affairs for the Muhammad Ali Center, said the application has already been sent. They are still awaiting word on whether Ali will get a stamp. "Muhammad is very deserving to be on a postage stamp," Conkey said. "He was a 3-time world heavyweight champion. He is a cultural icon. He was a civil rights activist. He was really the people's champion. This June will be 7 years since his passing. His legacy and relevance and impact still lives on, not just in Kentucky, but around the world. Villagrass and Lonnie Ali said they are not aware of previous applications to put Ali on a stamp. Other sports notables have been featured on stamps, but it is still an exclusive club. For example, the last baseball player to receive the honor was Yogi Berra in 2021. That stamp was issued 6 years after his death. He was the 30th baseball player to be featured on a stamp, according to a 2021 New York Times article. In comparison, there are 269 players in the Baseball Hall of Fame. It typically takes 3 years after a subject is selected for a stamp to be issued. This is a long legal process, Conkey said. Villagrass has pushed a publicity campaign to raise awareness about the effort to get Ali on a stamp. In June, former Louisville Mayor Greg Fisher and the Ali Center held a press conference touting the effort to get Ali a stamp. Other cities, including Lexington, Los Angeles, Santa Ana, California, other civic and state groups have also passed resolutions backing the effort to put Louisville's most famous son on a postage stamp. Villagrass said he grew up a Muhammad Ali fanatic. As the youngest of seven brothers, he admired Ali's prowess in the ring. "I got beat up for waking up," Villagrass said. But as the son of Mexican immigrant, he also admired Ali's courage. Ali would not bend to racism. He was not afraid. He gave oppressed people a voice. He was the true civil rights pioneer, he said. When I was growing up in the 1970s, we got sent to the principal's office for speaking Spanish, Villagrass said. He gave me inner strength, he said. Villagrass said Ali's message is needed more today than ever. A stamp would help a new generation understand Ali's message, he said. Not only is it a long overdue and earned recognition, but my hope is that it can help current and future generations of all ages and genders to be better people, Villagrass said, to help communities stand up for themselves and for what is right. And that concludes the article by Beth Musgrave entitled Behind the Push to Get Muhammad Ali on a U.S. Postage Stamp. Also on page 1 of the January 17th, 2023 edition of the Lexington Herald Leader is an article by Kelly Casales Cho from the Washington Post. It is entitled, As Forum Begins, Oxfam Calls for Billionaire Busting Taxes. The richest 1% of people on Earth made almost two-thirds of the new wealth created since the pandemic began, Oxfam said in a report released Monday, the opening day of the World Economic Forum in Davos, a ski resort in the Swiss Alps. The group proposed to increase taxes on billionaires' income. The world's richest have absorbed a greater proportion of global wealth during the pandemic and over the past decade, while global poverty has increased for the first time in 25 years, according to the report. Survival of the richest. It added that the planet is facing a polycrisis of climate change, cost of living burdens, widespread hunger, and an unprecedented decline in human development. Oxfam is calling on world leaders to significantly increase taxes on the ultra-wealthy. This includes higher taxes on income and capital gains, which it argued are the most important source of income for the rich in most countries. As a starting point, the world should aim to halve the wealth and number of billionaires between now and 2030, both by increasing taxes on the top 1% and adopting other billionaire-busting policies, the report said. This would bring billionaire wealth and numbers back to where they were just a decade ago in 2012. Oxfam timed its report to the start of the World Economic Forum, a gathering of the world's political and business elites that runs until Friday, with panels on a variety of topics scheduled, including human rights, the pandemic, climate change, and ways to prepare for an expected recession. The group called for countries to impose a tax rate of at least 60% on income from both labor and capital of the world's richest 1%, as well as overall higher rates for multimillionaires and billionaires. It said even a tax of up to 5% on the world's billionaires could raise about $1.7 trillion annually, enough money to lift 2 billion people out of poverty, as well as fund a global plan to end hunger. To illustrate the current state of tax discrepancies, Oxfam provided a stark example. Elon Musk, CEO of Tesla, SpaceX, and Twitter, paid a true tax rate of just over 3% from 2014 to 2018, while a market trader selling rice and flour in northern Uganda paid an income tax rate of 40%. While ordinary people are making daily sacrifices on essentials like food, the super rich have outdone even their wildest dreams, Gabriella Butcher, executive director of Oxfam International, said in a release. Just 2 years in, this decade is shaping up to be the best yet for billionaires, a roaring 20s boom for the world's richest. Daniel Bunn, president and CEO of the Tax Foundation, a U.S.-based nonprofit that focuses on the economics of tax policy, said a 60% marginal tax rate on the world's wealthiest 1% would be an enforcement challenge to begin with and could encourage avoidance or evasion. He said a broader tax base at a lower rate might be a better long-term option. He also said that lawmakers around the world should consider a progressive consumption tax, which essentially means taxing the ultra-wealthy when they spend money. He argues that it would make tax avoidance more difficult and more personal wealth easier to track. You can figure out how to avoid income taxes by relocating where you are in the world. You can choose to minimize your exposure to capital gains by holding your assets and not selling them, he said. But when you buy something, there is a transaction there. It's a less mobile factor. According to the Oxfam report, marginal tax rates of 60% or above on personal income of the rich were the norm for large parts of the 20th century. But taxes on personal income, dividend income, inheritances, and corporate income tax have generally declined since 1980 in rich countries. About half of the world's billionaires live in countries where there are no inheritance taxes, the report stated. And that concludes the article from page one by Kelly Kasulis Cho. As forum begins, Oxfam calls for billionaire busting taxes. Moving on to page 2, the January 17th edition, toll rises in Ukraine as military exercises raise concerns. This is an article from the Associated Press by Vasilisa Stepanenko and Andrew Muldrum. Ukrainian emergency crews on Monday sifted through what was left of a Dnipro apartment building destroyed by a Russian missile, placing bodies from one of the war's deadliest single attacks in months in black bags and gingerly carrying them across steep piles of rubble. Authorities said the death toll from Saturday's strike rose to 40 and that 30 people remained missing Monday. Tall cranes swung across the jagged gaps in a row of residential towers, the engines growling as residents of one of Ukraine's largest cities watched largely in silence under a gray sky. About 1,700 people lived in the multi-story building, and search and rescue crews have worked nonstop since the missile strike to locate victims and survivors in the wreckage. The regional administration said 39 people have been rescued and at least 75 were wounded. Fierce fighting continued to rage Monday in Ukraine's eastern Donetsk province, where military analysts have said both sides are likely suffering heavy troop casualties. No independent verification of developments was possible. The Russian and Belarusian air forces began a joint exercise Monday in Belarus, which borders Ukraine and served as a staging ground for Russia's February 24th invasion of Ukraine. The drills are set to run through February 1, the Belarusian Defense Ministry said. Russia has sent its warplanes to Belarus for the drills. The Institute for the Study of War, a Washington think tank, reported signs of the Kremlin taking steps to turn its Ukraine invasion into a major conventional war after months of embarrassing military reversals. What Moscow calls a special military operation aimed to capture the Ukrainian capital, Kiev, within weeks and to install a Kremlin-friendly regime there, but Russian forces ultimately withdrew from Kiev, the think tank said. Then came a successful Ukrainian counteroffensive in recent months before the onset of winter slowed military advances. The Kremlin is likely preparing to conduct a decisive strategic action in the next 6 months intended to regain the initiative and end Ukraine's current string of operational successes, the Institute for the Study of War said in a report late Sunday. It noted reports indicating the Russian military command was in serious preparations for an expanded mobilization effort, conserving mobilized personnel for future use, while seeking to boost military industrial production and reshuffling its command structure. That means Ukraine's Western allies will need to continue supporting Ukraine in the long run, the think tank said. NATO member nations have sought in recent days to reassure Ukraine that they will stay the course. The United Kingdom has pledged tanks and the U.S. military's new expanded combat training of Ukrainian forces began in Germany on Sunday. Poland's prime minister urged the German government to supply a wide range of weapons to Kiev and voiced hope that Berlin would soon approve a transfer of battle tanks. And that concludes the article entitled Toll Rises in Ukraine as Military Exercises Raise Concerns. Another article on page 2 of the Lexington Herald Leader is also attributed to the Associated Press. Flight recorders retrieved from site of crash in Nepal. Search teams retrieved the flight data and cockpit voice recorders Monday of a passenger plane that plummeted into a gorge on approach to a new airport in the foothills of the Himalayas, officials said, as investigators looked for the cause of Nepal's deadliest plane crash in 30 years. At least 69 of the 72 people aboard were killed, and officials believe the three missing are also dead. Rescuers combed through the debris scattered down a 984-foot deep gorge for them. Many of the passengers on Sunday's flight were returning home to Pokhara, though the city is also popular with tourists since it's the gateway of the Annapurna Circuit hiking trail. On Monday evening, relatives and friends were still gathered outside a local hospital, some shouting at officials to speed up the postmortems so they could hold funerals for their loved ones. It's still not clear what caused the crash, which took place less than a minute's flight from the airport on a mild day with little wind. In footage taken by a passenger out of a window as the plane came in for a landing, buildings, roads, and greenery are visible below. The video, by Sanu Jaswal and verified by the Associated Press, then shows a violent jolt and a series of jerky images accompanied by yelling before flames fill the screen. Nepal's Civil Aviation Authority said the aircraft last made contact with the airport, which began operations only 2 weeks ago from near Sirti Gorge. A witness who recorded footage of the plane's descent said it looked like a normal landing until the plane suddenly veered to the left. I saw that and I was shocked, said Bahora. I thought that today everything will be finished here after it crashes. I will also be dead. After it crashed, red flames erupted and the ground shook violently, Bahora said. Seeing that scene, I was scared, he added. Amit C., an experienced pilot and founder of India's Safety Matters Foundation, said Bahora's video appears to show a stall, a situation in which a plane loses lift, especially likely at low airspeeds. The twin-engine ATR-72 aircraft, operated by Nepal's Yeti Airlines, was completing the 27-minute flight from the capital, Kathmandu, to Bukhara, 125 miles west. It was carrying 68 passengers, including 15 foreign nationals, as well as 4 crew members, Nepal's Civil Aviation Authority said in a statement. The foreigners included 5 Indians, 4 Russians, 2 South Koreans, and 1 each from Ireland, Australia, Argentina, and France. Nirala, a spokesperson for the authorities, said the flight recorders will be handed over to investigators. Pemba Sherpa, spokesperson for Yeti Airlines, confirmed that both the flight data and the cockpit voice recorders were found. Nepal is home to 8 of the world's 14 highest mountains, including Mount Everest. A pilot who routinely flies an ATR 72-500 plane from India to Nepal said the region's topography, with its mountain peaks and narrow valleys, raises the risk of accidents and sometimes requires pilots to fly by sight rather than relying on instruments. The pilot, who works for a private Indian airline and insisted on anonymity due to company policy, called the ATR 72-500 an unforgiving aircraft if the pilot isn't highly skilled and familiar with the region's terrain and wind speeds. Hundreds of people have gathered outside the Pokhara Academy of Health and Science Western Hospital, where the bodies are being kept. And that concludes the article by Associated Press entitled Flight Recorders Retrieved from Site of Crash in Nepal. Next up on page 2 of the Lexington Herald Leader, U.S. expands combat training for Ukraine forces. This is an article by Lolita Balder of Associated Press. The U.S. military's new expanded combat training of Ukrainian forces began in Germany on Sunday with the goal of getting a battalion of about 500 troops back on the battlefield to fight the Russians in the next 5 to 8 weeks, said General Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Milley, who was visiting the Grafenwöhr training area on Monday to get a first-hand look at the program, said the troops being trained left Ukraine a few days ago. In Germany is a full set of weapons and equipment for them to use. Until now, the Pentagon had declined to say exactly when the training would start. The so-called combined arms training is aimed at honing the skills of the Ukrainian forces so they will be better prepared to launch an offensive or counter any surge in Russian attacks. They will learn how to better move and coordinate their company and battalion-sized units in battle using combined artillery, armor, and ground forces. Speaking to 2 reporters traveling with him to Europe on Sunday, Milley said the complex training, combined with an array of new weapons, artillery, tanks, and other vehicles heading to the Ukraine, will be key to helping the country's forces take back territory that has been captured by Russia in the nearly 11-month-old war. This support is really important for Ukraine to be able to defend itself, Milley said, and we're hoping to be able to pull this together here in short order. The goal, he said, is for all the incoming weapons and equipment to be delivered to Ukraine so that the newly trained forces will be able to use it sometime before the spring rains show up. That would be ideal. The new instruction comes as Ukrainian forces face fierce fighting in the eastern Donetsk province, where the Russian military has claimed it has control of the small salt mining town of Soledar. Ukraine asserts that its troops are still fighting, but if Moscow's troops take control of Soledar, it would allow them to inch closer to the bigger city of Bakhmut, where fighting has raged for months. Milley said he wants to make sure the training is on track and whether anything else is needed, and also ensure that it will line up well with the equipment deliveries. The program will include classroom instruction and field work that will begin with small squads and gradually grow to involve larger units. It would culminate with a more complex combat exercise, bringing an entire battalion and a headquarters unit together. Until now, the U.S. focus has been on providing Ukrainian forces with more immediate battlefield needs, particularly on how to use the wide array of Western weapon systems pouring into the country. And that concludes the article by Lolita Balder entitled U.S. Expands Combat Training for Ukraine Forces. And finally, on page 2, is a short article entitled Renner Cheers Show's Premiere Amid Recovery. Jeremy Renner commemorated the season 2 premiere of his show, Mayor of Kingstown, on Sunday as he recovered from a snowplow accident that left him critically injured. The star plays the lead character on the crime thriller series, which released the first episode of its latest season Sunday on the Paramount Plus streaming service. "Let me know what you think," Renner tweeted. He was hospitalized in intensive care January 1 after a snowplow ran over him near his Reno area home, according to officials. The actor, also known for portraying the superhero Hawkeye in the Marvel movies and shows, underwent surgery after suffering blunt chest trauma and orthopedic injuries, his representative said. The 52-year-old Renner has shared multiple posts on social media since the incident, including thanking fans for their support.
Welcome back to the reading of the news from today's edition of the Lexington Herald Leader. Today is Tuesday, January 17th, 2023. And your reader now is Bill Sally. As a reminder, Radio Eye is a reading service intended for those who are blind or who have other disabilities that make it difficult to read printed material. At this time, we'll go over Lexington's five-day forecast provided to us by AccuWeather. Today, expect a shower or two. The high is 59. The forecast low tonight, 40. The real feel today is 55 degrees. Tomorrow, Wednesday, expect a thick cloud cover with a high of 55 degrees and a low of 52 degrees. The real feel tomorrow will be 51 degrees. On Thursday, in the forecast is a shower and a thunderstorm or two. A high of 62 is forecast and a low of 35 degrees, with a real feel of 57 degrees. On Friday, it'll be cooler and partly sunny. A high of 42 is in the forecast and a low of 31 degrees. The real feel will be 36 degrees. On Saturday, it'll be mostly sunny. Expect a high of 46 degrees and a low of 33 degrees. The real feel on Saturday will be 49 degrees. In the Almanac of Weather Conditions through Sunday here in Lexington, the high temperature was 45 degrees and the low was 20 degrees. The normal high is 42 degrees and the normal low is 25 degrees. Last year's high was 37 degrees and last year's low was 25 degrees. The record high of 69 degrees was set just a couple of years ago in 2020. The record low of 11 below zero was set in 1893. On Sunday, there was no measured precipitation. That leaves our month-to-date and our year-to-date precipitation at 4.26 inches. Our normal month and year-to-date precipitation is 1.68 inches. Last year-to-date, we had 4.47 inches of precipitation. Our record for the date was 1.00 inches, set in 1959. In the sun and moon cycles, sunrise was at 7:53 a.m. today. Sunset will be at 5:44 p.m. Moonrise will be at 3:28 a.m. and moonset at 1:28 p.m. The next new moon will be on January 21st. The next first half moon will be on January 28th. The next full moon on February 5th. And the last half moon will be visible on February 13th. In the snow statistics, Sunday there was no snow measured. At month-to-date, we've only had a trace of snow here in Lexington. Our normal month-to-date snowfall is 2.0 inches. Our season-to-date snowfall is 2.2 inches. Our normal season-to-date snowfall is 4.3 inches. And last season-to-date, we had 9.9 inches of snowfall. In weather trivia, today's question: what state has never recorded a sub-zero Fahrenheit temperature? Do you know the answer? The answer is Hawaii. Aloha. And now we'll continue the reading of the news from today's Herald Leader by reviewing the obituaries. We read only the name, age, and location if given. Garland Edward Denny, 83, Nicholasville. Johnny Lee Howard, 75, Moorhead. Dan McLean, 77, London. Donna Lynn Butt Moore, 58, London. Robert Lewis Porter, 61, Nicholasville. Ricky Revis, 60, Paris. Michael Chad Ritchie, 51, Lawrenceburg. Jimmy Ross, 74, Whitley City. Wilma Stamper, 70, Paris. Robert Bobby Wasson, 82, Stamping Ground. Billy Wilson, 85, Hazard. If you'd like any more information about any of those listed in today's obituaries, we do have a location you can go to. It is hlobits, O-B-I-T-S, at herald-leader.com. Again, that's hlobits at herald-leader.com. Now, continuing with the news from today's Herald Leader, the next article is entitled, UK has thousands of unreturned Native American remains. This article is written by Monica Cast of the Lexington Herald Leader. The University of Kentucky is one of the largest holders of Native American remains and artifacts that have not been made available for return to tribes, a report from ProPublica published Wednesday showed. The William S. Webb Museum of Anthropology, located at UK, holds more than 4,500 Native American remains. Under the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, or NAGPRA, federal agencies and institutions are required to return Native American remains and cultural items to tribes. The law was passed in 1990 by Congress, but most remains located at museums and universities across the country still have not been returned. UK holds the sixth highest amount of Native American remains that have not yet been made available for return to tribes, according to ProPublica. Other institutions that also hold high numbers of unreturned remains include the University of California, Berkeley, the Illinois State Museum, and Harvard University. Regionally, the University of Tennessee at Knoxville and the Tennessee Valley Authority also hold high numbers of unreturned remains and items. Part of NAGPRA states that remains and objects do not have to be returned to tribes unless a tribe or organization makes a formal request for those items to be returned, which has allowed universities and institutions to keep items, ProPublica reported. ProPublica is a nonprofit newsroom that produces investigative and accountability journalism. The report from ProPublica showed that none of the items held by UK has been officially returned to tribes. UK spokesperson Whitney Siddiqui said Friday, progress is being made towards repatriation. UK holds 4,476 Native American ancestor remains and 7,757 funerary belongings, Siddiqui said. Of those, 610 ancestors and more than 5,600 funerary objects have been culturally affiliated and are in the process of being returned to tribes. Once complete, this one project will have repatriated about 15% of all Native ancestors held at the William S. Webb Museum, Siddiqui said. Native American remains came to UK through part of the New Deal's public works projects nearly a century ago, when archaeological sites across the nations were excavated. However, those excavations took the remains and cultural items of Native Americans without consent of the tribes and housed them at museums and institutions, including the Webb Museum. Data from ProPublica from the National Park Service, which tracks Native American remains and objects that have been reported under NAGPRA. The data is self-reported by institutions to the National Park Service, which tracks information about where remains and items were taken from, and where they are currently held, and if they've been made available for return to tribes, according to ProPublica. Next, UK investing in repatriation of remains and objects. On Friday, UK announced it was investing nearly $900,000 to return remains to Native Americans in Kentucky, with the goal of returning all remains and cultural items held by the museum in a, quote, transparent, respectful, and legal manner, following meaningful collaborative consultations with official tribal representation, UK said in a news release. UK Arts and Sciences Dean Anna Franco Watkins, who was hired last year, was familiar with repatriation under NAGPRA at her former institution, Auburn University. After Franco Watkins was hired, she began working to address repatriation more substantively. Siddiqui said the investment announced Friday had been considered as part of a, quote, long-term plan to make progress on repatriation. This significant step forward is a testament to the university's steadfast commitment to Native nations, Franco Watkins said in a release from UK. Much progress has been made over the past several years, but there is more we can do and must do to complete the sensitive process of repatriation with transparency, dignity, and respect. UK said it has implemented several initiatives in recent years related to NAGPRA, including developing a digital database for ancestral remains and objects and sharing it with Native nations, forming an NAGPRA advisory group, and building relationships with Native nations. We recognize the pain caused by past practices and continue to work closely with Native nations to return their ancestors and cultural items home in a transparent, respectful, and ethical process, UK's NAGPRA coordinator, Celise Chillicott-Frickner, said. In 2019, 12 employees in the Department of Anthropology and Webb Museum were fired. After two archaeology units were dissolved, an external review of the department praised its work training professional archaeologists and creating outreach programs and activities, while also expressing concern about the lack of an NAGPRA compliance officer. Chillicott-Frickner became the NAGPRA compliance officer in 2019. Repatriation efforts are expected to take several years to complete because of the size of UK's collection, the university said Friday. We are committed to repatriating all Native American ancestral remains and funerary belongings, sacred objects, and objects of cultural patrimony to Native nations, Chillicott-Frickner said. This investment will help make that commitment a reality. The next article is entitled, Many Fayette Kids Aren't Ready for Kindergarten. Can Bus Classrooms, Dolly Parton, Fix It? This article is written by Valerie Honeycutt Spears of the Lexington Herald-Leader. Nearly half of incoming Fayette County kindergartners do not meet the basic standards for starting their education, the lowest level since the readiness scores were first tracked in the 2013-2014 school year, district officials said this week. An initiative to improve kindergarten readiness for Fayette's youngest learners was announced Thursday, with Fayette County Public Schools Superintendent Demetrius Liggins saying two preschool buses will act as mobile classrooms for the district, able to hit the road to meet the needs of any neighborhood. With support from the Fayette County Board of Education, $10 million in federal elementary and secondary school emergency relief, ESSER funds, will be invested to expand early childhood efforts, allowing initiatives to get within easy reach of families and caregivers, especially those in underserved communities. Another integral part of the initiative, announced by Fayette Education Foundation Executive Director Carrie Bowling, will be the arrival of Dolly Parton's Imagination Library to the community, a book gifting program that mails free, high-quality books to children from birth to age 5, no matter their family's income, officials said Thursday. Incoming kindergartners are screened each year for readiness to learn standards based on adaptive, cognitive, motor, communications, and social-emotional skills, according to a news release from the City of Lexington and the Fayette County School District. Those factors are then used to compile the readiness score. For the 2021-22 school year, Fayette County kindergartners scored a 42% on the readiness score. Liggins said the district had a goal of attaining 100% kindergarten readiness levels by the 2027-28 school year, bolstered by this campaign. which he said will also include more family outreach and engagement efforts, expanding access to pre-kindergarten, and creating and distributing growth and development guides to caregivers, as well as online and app-based resources. The early childhood education efforts will be executed from within the school district's existing program, First 5 Lex, which has shared its Read, Talk, Play message with families and caregivers since 2017. The new campaign will allow the message to go further and to meet families where they are, whether at home, in their doctor's office, at the library, or at an older sibling's school, and within their native language, a news release said. The next article is entitled, Getting a COVID Vaccine During Pregnancy Benefits Fetal Health, New University of Kentucky Study Finds. This article is written by Alex Aquisto of the Lexington Herald Leader. New research co-authored by University of Kentucky researchers shows fetal benefits when a pregnant person is vaccinated against COVID-19. The study, funded by a National Institutes of Health grant, was published in the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology in late November. It followed a group of 121 women from March 2021 until June 2022 through pregnancy, delivery, and up to a year after giving birth. Each participant received two rounds of the vaccine and a booster shot. Close to 90% of the cohort got the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. Scientists from UK and Oregon Health and Science University monitored antibody levels via blood samples from the mother, the newborn, the umbilical cord, and the mother's breast milk. Researchers found that antibodies from the vaccine, quote, passively transfer from the mother to fetus in utero, offering the most protection, said Dr. Ihim Mesoudi, chair of UK's Department of Microbiology, Immunology, and Molecular Genetics. So at birth, these babies had maternal antibodies in circulation, which is fantastic. Getting vaccinated during pregnancy not only protected their mom, but also now provided passive protection for their newborns, who are not eligible for the vaccine, she added. Researchers then found a, quote, dramatic increase of antibodies in a mother's breast milk, increasing 2 to 3-fold in the weeks following birth. There was a massive increase in antibodies, which was unexpected but great to see, Mesoudi said. You really needed the first two shots in the booster to achieve excellent protection, to have that very long-lived, durable immune response. Then the newborn is protected via antibody transfer in utero, through the placenta, and postnatal through breastfeeding. We now have a really large number of studies on vaccinations in pregnant women, she said. They've all shown great safety, tolerability, and immunogenicity, so we've hit the trifecta. The vaccines are safe and work. That's what's really important. This new study is the latest in a growing body of research that points to the safety and efficacy of vaccination during pregnancy, a time when one's immune system is considerably weakened and puts a person at greater risk of severe COVID-19 infection. In the fall of 2021, months after COVID-19 vaccines first became widely accessible, pregnant people were among the least vaccinated groups, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Healthcare providers across the country sounded the alarm on the severe risks this low rate posed to mothers and fetuses, and reported a notable spike in severe COVID infections and subsequent hospitalization among this group that year, including in Kentucky. An unvaccinated pregnant person who gets COVID-19 also faces a greater chance of preterm birth. The latest study acknowledged an ongoing, quote, high level of vaccine hesitancy among the pregnant population. Vaccination decisions during pregnancy are often influenced by a primary goal of protecting neonatal health, researchers wrote in the latest study. Thus, the decision to vaccinate during pregnancy or to delay vaccination is shaped by knowledge about the impact of vaccine timing and duration of protection. The study's conclusions show that the, quote, best neonatal protection against COVID-19 is for a pregnant person to receive the 3-dose vaccination series at any point during pregnancy, which allows for placental antibody transfer and then to, quote, subsequently breastfeed their children for at least 6 months, at which point infants are eligible for SARS-CoV-2 vaccination. 8 of the study's 10 researchers work at the University of Kentucky, including Dr. Delphine Marlbury, Madison Blanton, Brianna Dorat, Heather True, Taylor McDonald, Caroline Beauregard, and Ruben Antwoord-Warvar. The next item is entitled Barry's defense of controversial UK mural is getting stale. This item appears on the opinion page, and it's written by Joy Miracle. She is a research assistant, an old-time musician, and a small-scale farmer in central Kentucky. Both Wendell Berry's and Anne Rice O'Hanlon's work draw similar criticism for their romanticized depictions of rural America. Despite this, I have a measure of regard for Wendell Berry's works. In fact, I have two family members named Wendell, after the great writer. However, for me, it's becoming harder to appreciate this Wendell as he digs his heels deeper into the issue of the University of Kentucky's controversial mural. O'Hanlon's magnum opus was commissioned in 1934 by the Treasury Relief Art Project, a federal program that was part of the New Deal to provide income and create art during the Great Depression. Born in Ashland in 1908, O'Hanlon, Nee Rice, was privileged enough to graduate from UK with an art degree, then attended the San Francisco School of Fine Arts. She married another artist and briefly relocated to Kentucky for the creation of this federally funded mural. Just 55 years before O'Hanlon was born, the song My Old Kentucky Home was published about, by one interpretation, what a wonderful place Kentucky was to be enslaved. The context of this song, as well as the context surrounding the mural in question, is rich and interesting, and worthy of discussion. In 1986, the song was revised. Perhaps in 2023, Memorial Hall can be similarly revised to reflect a fuller and deeper understanding of the history of all peoples on this land commonly called Kentucky. In his appeal to readers on December 22nd, Berry seems to equate an artistic depiction with historical import. What inherent value does this, quote, public work of art contain? Berry only offers that it was considered significant at the time by, quote, qualified critics, including UK employees. Then he asks, quote, what would they think of the fresco if there were no black people in it? The issue isn't, quote, whether certain people are depicted in a near-century-old mural, but how. To claim that it is of cultural and historical significance just because it already exists is similar to claiming Confederate shrines are also. Oh wait, Berry said that too. That a thing exists does not necessarily warrant its continued existence, though the reasons for change should be well examined. Change is not erasure. Looking at the mural myself, I just don't see great art. It comes across as a poor imitation of fellow trap artist Diego Rivera. The nostalgic, romantic representations of harmonious caricatures do not accurately represent Kentucky's beginnings. Where is the genocide? The slave auctions? If it is free speech, as Berry claims, then it is inaccurate and misinformed speech. If freedom is in question, why does Berry's freedom matter more than that of the students who protest the mural? An institution of higher education may do well to represent something else. If UK's Memorial Hall was to be a monument to honor the students and graduates killed in World War I, then this mural does no such thing. If it is indeed the property of the public, then why can't the public have a say in what happens to it? All buildings matter to Wendell Berry, and rectifying a wrong is censorship. Whether Berry is grasping for his family's legacy or his races, as a Kentuckian and UK employee, I am tired of this narrative. We cannot know the intentions, motivations, or implicit biases of any person, even a family member. Berry's insistence that his wife's aunt was certainly not racist just doesn't land. The more or less fictional citizens of Port William didn't have to spend too much effort working on race relations in their historical, geographical, and literary context. Certainly, the context surrounding the nostalgic and romanticized writings of Wendell Berry is complex and worthy of discussion. Now it seems to me that Berry and his family have said all that I care to hear about the history of Kentucky. He's spoken well, and I took much of it to heart. Now I want to hear different voices. Again, this was written by Joy Miracle, a research assistant, an old-time musician, and small-scale farmer in central Kentucky. The next item is entitled, "With Stature Rising, Kentucky's Comer Targets the Quote Big Dog." This is written by David Cantonese of McClatchyDC.com. James Comer is beginning to be recognized in airports. Even before he took the gavel of the House Oversight Committee this month, the Tompkinsville, Kentucky congressman was becoming synonymous with the incoming Republican opposition to the Biden administration. In December alone, Comer appeared on Fox News programs 20 times. He hit Newsmax, NBC's Meet the Press, CNN, CBS, and CNBC, too. Just this week, he was back on Sean Hannity's program in prime time, alongside Speaker Kevin McCarthy. "Yeah, I feel it," the 50-year-old Comer told McClatchy in a recent interview. "I guess I'm in the middle of my 5 minutes of fame." Given the stack and breadth of the investigations he's teeing up for 2023, the fame isn't likely to stretch on longer than the typical 15. Comer once dreamed of being governor of Kentucky, a goal that could remain in reach down the road. But through his own tenacity and affability, along with the gift of fortuitous timing, he's now embarking on one of the highest profile jobs in Washington, a committee chairmanship packing tremendous power and obvious rewards. It is not without risk. There's a lot of pressure, too, to deliver on some of these investigations that the Republican faithful have been wanting to happen for a long time, Comer said. "What I've said to many people, especially to more right-wing interviews I do, I don't convict, I don't indict, I don't impeach, but we're going to investigate." Even so, what he's already asserted amounts to a staggering political indictment that could become the central point of contention in his investigatory quest that the president lied. Republicans on the House Committee on Oversight and Accountability will probe the Biden administration's handling of COVID-19, the overwhelmed southern border, the rushed departure from Afghanistan, and even potentially the most recent revelation of classified documents discovered at the president's private office. But Comer has already made clear that a large chunk of the committee's bandwidth will be devoted to getting to the bottom of whether President Joe Biden is compromised by foreign business dealings arranged by his son, Hunter, and his brother, James, in hostile countries. Comer can't answer that quite yet. But what I do know is Joe Biden has lied about his knowledge and his involvement in what his family was doing with our adversaries across the globe, Comer said in the interview. He has sought to stress that his investigation is not aimed at Biden's troubled son, whose sexual exploits and struggles with drugs are well documented, but the president himself. At a press conference in the U.S. Capitol following the election, Comer, flanked by members of the committee he'll command, was empathetic about his target. To be clear, Joe Biden is the big dog. This concludes the reading of the news from today's edition of the Lexington Herald Leader. Today is Tuesday, January 17th, 2023. Your readers today have been Heidi Newman and Bill Sally, yours truly. Thank you so much for listening. And now stay tuned for sports news right here on Radio I.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.